Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of February. We get to talk about Frank Lloyd Wright in the Milwaukee Art Museum. Doesn't get much better than this hour, this next hour. Brady Roberts is our guest. He is chief curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum and put together this wonderful exhibit. He was very, very kind to us, Rhonda and Chrissy. And I went to the art museum, and Brady took us through the exhibit last week, and it was just, you know how you carve, every time we go to the art museum, we're just lifted. It's a wonderful place, and it's a beautiful exhibit. Frank Lloyd Wright, Organic Architecture for the 21st Century, 150 works, drawings, 33 have never been exhibited publicly, scale models, furniture, photography, and also some very interesting movie footage, we'll ask Brady about that, of Frank Lloyd Wright. So it's running through May 15th. It opened last week, and we hope that you'll have a chance to see it, but we're going to learn about Frank Lloyd Wright, an enormously influential, and I wish he had been even more influential, architect. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email, if you want to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Brady. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We had a good time yesterday. Well, it was last week now. It was just it's a great exhibit, and you must love your job.
It's wonderful, particularly when you get to work on a project like this.
Uh-huh. I would imagine. So have you had a special place in your heart for Frank Lloyd Wright for much of your life?
Well, I have. I grew up in Illinois, and I remember the first time I saw a Wright project, my mom took me to the Dana House in Springfield.
Oh,
and I
sure.
remember I was excited about it. So I had an idea of who Frank Lloyd Wright was, or a picture in my mind. And I just thought it was a mind-blowing experience because it was such a complex house spatially. You know, there are compressed areas that feel very cave-like and then expansive areas, but it's beautiful, just a stunning house. So it made a very strong impression on me, and I've been interested in Wright ever since.
You must have liked that little bowling alley in the basement.
That was pretty stunning.
Isn't it? And when you're a kid, that could have gotten
what a great idea.
Frank Lloyd Wright. It was a great idea. Yeah, great idea. You know, as I was looking in the exhibit, I was thinking he did build some incredibly wonderful buildings. I wish that his impact had been even greater, so that some of those utopian visions he had of how we live and where we live and what our smaller communities look like, and affordable housing for people that was interesting. I wish that had taken off more than it did.
Well, and it's really the purpose of this exhibition is to explore the relevance of Wright today, from things like the affordable house all the way to his suburban design. So Broadacre City and the Living City, which he envisioned as alternatives to American cities, but we look at them today, and these are very elegant solutions for the sort of homogeneity that's so typical of suburbia across the country.
Tell me about the Broadacre plan that you have. It's extraordinary.
We have the model that Frank Lloyd Wright made with his students in the 1930s, and it's 12 by 12 feet. And this is a model that represents a 16-square-mile section that could be repeatable across the country. And the idea actually occurred to Wright in the 1920s when he drove across the country and realized that so much of our nation is uninhabited. He said there's no reason why every family shouldn't have 1 acre, hence Broadacre City. And the design of this plan is that all of the architecture works harmoniously with the landscape. It's a very beautiful sort of idea. And as you go through the exhibition, you see that Wright is always taking his signals and his clues from nature. He's always using local materials. He liked to build efficiently. He liked to build affordably. And he liked his architecture to be harmonious with the landscape. So in envisioning Broadacre City, he realized that the landscape and terrain changes so much across this country that every one of these Broadacre modules would be different as the landscape varied. So they become not homogenous, but very sort of custom to the locale. And also, when he was designing his small affordable houses, he always had options for the client on the number of bedrooms, the kind of roof, the kind of woodwork, so that every house could be custom customized, even if it was something that could be mass produced. And these are ideas that have been lost and that are worth reexamining today.
And what was it? And it is true of all of the pictures that you have and the drawings and the houses that he built, that he did in a beautiful way work in accordance with the landscape. So he looked at what it was and built things according to the hills and the water that was there. And most places are just level the ground so we can build as many places as we can. Was a lot less expensive to do it that way, or why did we go that way?
Yeah, that's really the key question, is why didn't we go that way? And I think that in the United States, you know, we don't really have urban planning. We don't have suburban planning. It's developers that go in and buy a parcel of land, and they're building for profit. But it's not necessarily more affordable to go in with a bulldozer and erase nature and then build the cookie-cutter houses. So if you work with the natural environment, it can be more cost-effective. And one of the things that Wright did repeatedly is he was using local materials. So when he built Taliesin, he used limestone from nearby quarries. He did the same thing at Falling Water. When he designed the Bayeres house for Acapulco, he incorporated the natural boulders on that site. And for, you know, particularly in luxury commissions, architects bring in materials from all over the world, and it's a very expensive way to build. And, of course, there's energy that's consumed in transporting materials across the world. So Wright was very efficient and sort of eco-friendly before that was a concept.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about his life, which was a big life, a tragic life, an unusual life in many regards. He was born in our state.
Yes.
And you can see, for people who haven't seen Taliesin, it's certainly worth a visit. The influences on him, was it his mom? Did he meet some famous architect in the hills? Or
His mother said that before Wright was born that she was going to have a boy and he would be an architect. And very early on, she gave him the Froebel blocks, the little geometric play blocks. And Wright, you know, really enjoyed playing with those and thought about architecture and building throughout his life. Also, his father was a musician and played piano. And Wright often made a comparison between music and architecture. And he loved Beethoven. His father would play Beethoven sonatas before he would go to bed. And Wright would listen to the structure of music and said it was very much like the composition of architecture.
But his father split the scene.
Yes, he did, and that would be Wright's MO as an adult as well. So, which is ironic because as he was building houses, he was very concerned about the clients and about creating a warm family environment in his domestic architecture. Mm.
And do you think that he did have, even though he may have had several warm family environments, did he have that, or was family difficult for him?
Well, I think what he talked about was the great sort of intellectual influence and spiritual influence. His father was a preacher, and Wright had an evangelical bent about architecture, but spiritually he was connected with the landscape, and he grew up reading Emerson and Thoreau and the Transcendentalists, and this really helped form his vision of architecture. And late in his life, Mike Wallace interviewed him and asked him if he believed in God, and Wright just kind of laughed because it was such a simplistic notion for him, but he really saw spiritual communion with nature, mm-hmm. and that was a manifestation of, you know, something greater, and his architecture was trying to be harmonious with the natural environment. So that was, for Wright, a very spiritual endeavor.
I had read that he took, was it a couple classes, or was it much more extensive than that, in civil engineering at Madison?
Yeah, he studied briefly at the University of Wisconsin, but, you know, quickly decided that he had learned everything that they could offer him and made
and
his way.
He probably had.
Yeah, and, you know, he was incredibly precocious and made his way to Chicago and very quickly was working for Louis Sullivan, where he became the master draftsman for Sullivan, which is a position that served him well later, because as master draftsman, he was basically in charge of all the people who were doing drawings, who were creating Louis Sullivan's vision, and he could then train architects to do the same for him, and he thought of his apprentices as like fingers of his hand, and he relied heavily on these people. You know, the Frank Lloyd Wright archives at the foundation in Scottsdale, where we drew the majority of our material from. They have 22,000 drawings by Frank Lloyd
Wright.
Oh,
my gosh.
Yeah, it's just an extraordinary resource. And, of course, Wright lived a very long time as a practicing architect, working over seven decades. But he could not have been so prolific without the assistance of these architectural draftsmen.
So would you say that he felt satisfied in the number of actual completions of those drawings that he made?
That's a good question. You know, he built over 500 projects. He designed more than twice that number. But throughout his late career, beginning in the 1930s, he was really thinking about visions for building the whole United States. So Usonia, United States of North America, the first Usonian houses in Madison, and he built over 100 Usonian houses across the country, but he envisioned this as a whole building system for the United States, just as Broadacre City was a vision for decentralization, for an alternate to industrial cities. So it must have been frustrating in some respects for him to not see those kind of projects take hold. And we have an interesting project in the exhibition called the Cloverleaf that was designed in the 1940s. And it was a whole community that he envisioned for Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And this was very close to groundbreaking when a state government official came in and said, wait a minute, Frank Lloyd Wright's not a Massachusetts architect. We can't build this project. So it was killed. But, that would have been something, a whole community along the lines of his bigger vision of architecture and society. So I think it probably was frustrating to him to not build projects like that. However, when you look at some of the nearly impossible kind of projects that he did build. The S.C. Johnson Great Workroom is this extraordinary cathedral space. Falling Water is
an
almost impossible idea of incorporating a waterfall in a house. You know, a number of architects throughout history have designed fantastical sorts of projects that are never built, that are brilliant designs. But Wright built his share of brilliant designs. The Guggenheim Museum, I mean, it's still surprising today when you walk down Fifth Avenue and you see that great spiraling form. It's just spectacular.
It's hard to believe, isn't it, that when you look at all of these buildings, you're looking at 1950, 1940. It's as though they ought to be 2025. They've always had this, there's something so unique and so forward-looking and really forward-looking. It's hard to believe he did it in his time.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I love driving down Terrace Avenue and looking at all the turn-of-the-century mansions and then seeing the Boak House,
right,
his 1916 house, and it's such a modernist temple. And it's such a beautiful, exquisite piece of architecture. It just pops out, stands out distinct from everything else around it.
Yeah, it sure does. So, and I want to go back to Broadacre for just a moment. This is probably the last time it will be exhibited because it's fairly old.
That's right.
Right.
I mean, he built it in the 1930s, and he actually traveled with this model nationally. He even went to Rockefeller Center, which must have been the heart of evil for him, because right, the way that he envisioned the city, he saw these as places where people led pretty miserable existences. He thought that cities were noisy and dirty and congested, and that people lived in very small apartments and that they had to work hard to pay the landlord. They were basically wage slaves. So he thought this was a terrible way to live. So he built this model and he went out and proselytized nationally. And I think, part of the reason why this never took off was that there were certain issues, for instance, government. In Broadacre City, Wright saw a sort of form of county government where the head of government would be the architect. So I think ideas like that probably didn't seem very practical to anyone. And there are issues with land distribution. I mean, if every family gets an acre, how will that be parceled out? So there are important details that were never addressed. But we're looking at this model today in terms of an elegant design, an alternative to suburbia. And it's very beautiful. And it's kind of a relic, too. I mean, this is an object that has a certain aura in that it's handmade. All of the students who worked on it signed it. There's that kind of Cherokee red square. It's on the front of the model. And Frank Lloyd Wright signed a small square, and he had all his students sign the big square. So it's just a very interesting artifact. But it wasn't designed to be around for hundreds of years, so it is quite fragile, and this is probably the last time it'll travel to a museum show.
You even found footage of Frank Lloyd Wright. It's like old home movies, black and white. Where did you find
this
that?
This is a remarkable thing that Barbara Brownlee, who's been the head of the docents at the Milwaukee Art Museum for 50 years, when I started working on this show about a year and a half ago, she said, Brady, you know, we have film footage of Frank Lloyd Wright at Taliesin downstairs in our archives. And I thought, really? Are you kidding me? I couldn't believe it, but Barbara knows her stuff. So I talked to our librarian, Heather Winter, and she and her assistant went down, and they found these 16-millimeter films that Denkmar Adler of Adler & Sullivan's granddaughter had donated to the Milwaukee Art Museum. Denkmar Adler's granddaughter was a docent at the museum and donated these films to us in the 1960s. So we screened them on the walls downstairs in the archives of the museum. And from that, we created a 12-minute loop that shows kind of life at home at Taliesin. And what you see, it's really wonderful because it's Frank Lloyd Wright in his cape and his beret with his cane, looking very imperious, like sort of master of the universe. But you also see many scenes of the people there farming the land, communing with nature, picnicking, going to the races, eating watermelon. And he's living the lifestyle that he advocated. So it is this direct connection with nature. So it's really remarkable, and it brings the kind of personal human experience of Taliesin directly to our viewers.
And they all look so darn healthy, don't they?
How about it?
You know? They really do.
He lived to be almost 90 years old, so I think there's something to this lifestyle.
Let's welcome phone. Oh, our lines are all filled. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we'll take your phone calls momentarily. Brady Roberts, chief curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum, is our guest, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. Liz in Lannan, our first caller. Hi, Liz.
Hi, I'll make my comments and then get off the line, but I'm so excited about this exhibit, and with it being the 100th anniversary, I encourage everyone to make plans to go to Taliesin and Spring Green and tour the entire estate, the estate, the Hillside School, and theater, and he was so important about telling us also furnishings and furniture are as much a part of our home as the nature we bring into it. And I just wish that Taliesin and Spring Green would promote that area so much more than they do. I would love to see it on a billboard. And it just seems like House on the Rock does a better job at promoting themselves than many people think. That's Taliesin and Spring Green, and it's not.
Yeah, some people do think that. You're right. Well, you know, in a way, you don't want it promoted too much because it's this secret, beautiful treasure, and you don't want a lot of people there, but it is worth seeing. And then you go to the American Players Theater, too, and it's just one of those great, great times. What do you think, Brady?
Well, you know, I've been surprised, and the people that I've talked to in this state, so many people have been to Taliesin, and it's not an esoteric place. And I know that the tours there actually get filled up every year. They're only open from May to October, but it's a great time to go and visit there. And in the exhibition, we actually have the floor plans for all of the iterations of Taliesin. So we have the original from 1911, and then after the fire in 1914, he built Taliesin II, and he expanded it. And then again in 1925, it burned down. And, you know, all the fires that happened, it never burned any of his workspace. So none of his drawings were ever destroyed in the fires. And he said, it's as if God had rejected my behavior but not my architecture.
Ooh.
So it's a very interesting take that he had on it. And, you know, these were devastating events, particularly the first fire for him, but he had the strength to rebuild. And it's interesting to look at the plans because it's kind of a U-shaped floor plan, with the living areas on the right and then the long central area that's the work area and then the farm areas that are the other part of the U. But that U goes on the crown of the hill. He doesn't build on top of the hill. The word Taliesin means shining brow, and it was a Welsh word, and it incorporated Wright's idea of building with nature. So instead of building on top of the hill, he's working with the natural environment. And when you go there, The rusticated stones, those rough-cut field stones, make it look like an old abbey, like it's been there for centuries. And this is something that Wright consciously did, that he had a grammar of architecture that was very modernist in the geometric reduction of forms, but also he would have this quality of ancientness and something that looked like it was part of the landscape. It's a very interesting mix, and you see that at Taliesin.
It's really beautiful. Nice description of it. Very. Thank you, Liz, for your call. Dave and Cobb, hi.
Good morning.
Hi, Dave.
On the Iowa County side by Clyde Township.
What township, Dave?
Clyde.
Clyde Township? I missed the first part of what you said. What's there?
Is that the regular Taliesin that had the fire and everything in Clyde Township?
Clyde Township.
Well, it's in Taliesin's in Spring Green, Wisconsin, so it's just west of Madison. I'm not sure if there's a name of a township there.
Thank you.
Have you seen it, Dave?
Pardon?
Have you seen it, Dave?
Yes, I've been driving by there every once in a while, and it's on the south side of the Wisconsin River.
Uh-huh.
And it's, there's a little side road called County Trunk C.
Uh-huh.
And you take that, it's on the corner of C and 23.
All right. Thanks for the directions. Thank you, Dave, for the call. And we go to Frank in Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Marvelous anniversary to celebrate. I've always had a suspicion that modern suburbia could be blamed on Frank Lloyd Wright, but I don't think that was his intention. But I have a different question. To what degree did Wright influence European modernism, you know, Gropius and the Bauhaus, or was it the other way around, or is there evidence for cross-feeding? Because Gropius's conceit, the glass house, to me is very Wright-like, and should I be conflating them in any way? And thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and actually it's a very complicated topic. But early on, Wright, when he was having troubles in Chicago, was invited to go to Berlin and publish a lithographic portfolio of his existing architecture to date. The Wasmuth portfolio is the name of the publisher. And so it was his prairie-style architecture. And when this publication hit, it was, for architects working in Europe, this was an earth-shattering moment. So Walter Gropius was a young architect at the time who was working in a very 19th-century idiom. And Peter Behrens was leading architect in Germany at the time. And they just stopped working to absorb the visual information of this portfolio. And it definitely changed and influenced the early development of Bauhaus and international style architecture. So early on, Wright was influential. There are questions that I think need to be resolved by scholars. You know, Wright traveled extensively. He always acknowledged Japanese architecture as an influence on him. And, of course, you see in Japanese architecture the geometric reduction of form. And he also appreciated their honest use of materials and their connection with nature. He said that the Japanese architects were very pure organic architects. But he never acknowledged seeing anything like the Wiener Werkstätte architects and Joseph Hoffmann and Wagner and so forth. So we don't know if he was aware of those avant-garde architects working in Europe, you know, prior to the development of the prairie style. And then later in his career, he really disassociated himself from the international style. But given his travels and his reading, he certainly had to be aware of them. So I would suspect that there was a dialogue that occurred, although people didn't admit to it.
We had Arlo Guthrie with us last week, and we were talking about Frank Lloyd Wright. And he said that he had stayed in a hotel in... Was it in Tokyo or Kyoto?
The Imperial Hotel.
Designed by Wright?
Yes, that
it was
the early in his career in the teens, he built the Imperial Hotel, and he designed it to withstand earthquake shock, and it did in the 20s. But then there was another earthquake later that damaged it, and the building was torn down, which was a real tragedy. It could have been restored and preserved, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So Guthrie must have been there before the late 1960s.
Mm-hmm. We go to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I was wondering, there have been so many books written about Frank Lloyd Wright, and autobiographies and biographies as well, and I just pulled down Brendan Gill's book, Many Masks, from my bookcase and took a look at it again. I was wondering what you might recommend is something that gave a fair and balanced look at him, because so many of the autobiographies, not the autobiographies, but the biographies, seem to deal with the more scandalous parts of his life.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And my favorite monograph on Wright is by Robert Twombly, a scholar who spent many, many years studying Wright. And this is a book you can get at bookstores all over the place. I think it's in its third edition now. He first published it in the 1970s, and it's been reprinted and updated since then. But it gives a very balanced account of Wright's life and his architectural development. So that's my favorite single source. And then for this exhibition, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation has a quarterly publication, and the current one addresses the themes in our show about organic architecture in the 21st century. And it was written principally by Bruce Brooks Pfeiffer, who's the director of archives there, and he worked with Frank Lloyd Wright for the last 10 years of his career. So he's an amazing resource and this kind of living link to Frank Lloyd Wright. So he has a unique perspective. And also in that issue, there's an essay on the Boak House here in Milwaukee, written by Nicholas Olsberg, who's also a very respected architectural historian. And this is the best research on the Boak House, which is a very unusual commission for Wright. It's probably his most classical building. It looks like a Greek temple. And it was unusual for Wright, who usually said rhetorically that he had a real disdain for Renaissance and neoclassical architecture because it was dead architecture.
Hmm. And how do you spell Robert's last name?
T-W-O-M-B-L-Y.
O-M-B-L-Y.
Yeah, Twombly.
Yeah, I spelled that wrong. Okay, thank you. Thanks, Nancy, very much for the call. June in Toronto, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Brady. My son is a builder, and we have many discussions about this. And he's a conservative, I'm afraid. But we both agree that Frank Lloyd Wright could have built better and more interesting buildings if he had the materials that are available today. Is that so?
Well, that's a very interesting observation because Wright talked about organic architecture as being appropriate to time, people, and place. And what he really meant by time is that an architect should be of their time and take advantage of all of the tools that will advance their architectural ideas. So as much as Wright loved nature and connected with it, he also loved the rapid march of technology in the 20th century, and he was always utilizing new technologies to push the language of architecture. So when you look at his key forms, he uses cantilevers all the time. The Prairie House, he could only open up the floor plan of the Prairie House by using steel support in the roof section, which means that he didn't need posts all over the place and he didn't need these walls to support the ceiling. So he could have an open floor plan. And he used a lot of new technologies. He loved in the post-war period. He was doing all sorts of concrete block houses built with rebar and using standard size casement windows and doors, Pella doors, Anderson windows, Masonite siding to build prefabricated houses that were inexpensive and could be constructed very easily. So I suspect that today Frank Lloyd Wright would be on the forefront of using computer-aided drafting to create architecture that looked very organic. Kind of, if you think of Frank Gehry, You know, he's someone who builds architectural forms that would be impossible to build without computers. You wouldn't be able to engineer what he does without a computer. And Gary likes to draw fish and flowers. Those are the sort of abstracted forms that are the basis of his architecture. I think his language is sort of restricted in a way where one Frank Gehry building starts to look like another. So if you think of what Frank Lloyd Wright could do with a computer, you know, it would be sort of endless for him. The endless possibilities of building organic forms with the aid of computers.
Well, are there still students at Taliesin?
There are. I think they become sort of Wright disciples in a way. So to me, it's more interesting to look at the principles of organic architecture, like this aspect of using technology and carry forward those ideals. The principles are very valuable in connecting with the landscape harmoniously, designing beautiful buildings for people. I mean, particularly think of his corporate buildings like SC Johnson. Think of corporate buildings today. So many have an inhuman scale that just dwarfs the individual. SC Johnson is a beautiful building that's appropriately scaled for the individual. And that's something that he did time and again. Even the Guggenheim Museum, it's a very soaring experience. But as you're walking around, you're connecting with everyone that's in that museum. You can see people above you and beneath you on that ramp and see everyone. It's this communal sensibility. So he had these great ideals that I think are important to investigate now.
And you have a great model. Where did that come from that's in the exhibit?
You know, we have a number of models. We have two models of the SC Johnson building, one that was built in the 1980s for an exhibition that belongs to SC Johnson. They were very generous with their archives. And then we have a 21st century model. It's a laser cut model that shows the whole building complex. And it's fascinating because it's hard to get a handle on that building when you're visiting. It's so large, and there are two commissions, right, built it in the 1930s and then added the research tower in the 1940s. So this model gives you an understanding of how the whole thing functions. And then with the interior model, you get a complete understanding of the space. But actually, the model making today, the quality of the models that we have in this exhibition from the Unity Temple, the Jacobs House model, the S.E. Johnson model, they're just stunning objects in their own right.
Mm-hmm. They should be in a museum.
They should.
Yeah. Thank you, June. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. It is the 100th anniversary of Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's home studio and school in Spring Green. The Milwaukee Art Museum has a beautiful exhibit on his career, and it goes now through May 15. Well worth your seeing. Ron is our next caller. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I can't say enough about the experience I've had with Frank Lloyd Wright's brilliance in design and thoughts. I was introduced to his Unity Temple in Oak Park by a young architectural student and became so enamored with what I was experiencing that I became a member of the church and then served on the board of directors and had a lot of experience with what his thoughts were when he designed the building. A friend of mine and I created a theater group, a small community theater group, and we used the temple as the theater. It was similar to a theater in the round, except it was square, but the acoustics were so fine that you, from the second balcony, you could hear a whisper on the main floor. It was something that just moved me whenever I walked. There were many times I would walk through the building alone and just sit in experience what his feeling was. In fact, there's a kind of a story that he wasn't at the first public opening. He was a little bit shaken by his fear of whether it was going to be accepted or not. And when he heard that it was overwhelmingly accepted, he was holding his daughter and he threw her up in the air with excitement. He was just so tickled that that the public had accepted it. And we were commissioned. I was a photographer at the time, and we were commissioned to do some official photographs of the temple. And when we asked the village if we could do these photographs, we would have to do them from the middle of Lake Street, which was a very busy street. They gladly shut down the street so that we could do the photographs. but in fact, there were some talk about building a kind of a small high rise. I think it was to the west of the building, which would have blocked the sunlight that came through his stained glass windows and illuminated the interior. And it was voted down because they didn't want to damage the beauty of the temple itself.
Mm. His roots are deep.
Well, that's a great story and really a key point about the natural light. And Wright did have a very special, you know, fondness for that building because he was a Unitarian and that was his first church commission. So it's obviously a commission that he took very seriously. And it's interesting that you did a theatrical performance in that building. It makes sense because Wright designed that, the floor plan, so that it's a square floor plan, and everyone in the congregation faces each other. So it is, I can see how you'd say it's like theater in the round. I mean, you experience everyone else in that space. But the key is really the coffered ceiling, the skylight through the coffered ceiling and the clear story windows and that beautiful natural illumination that lights the whole congregation. And it would have been tragic if they had built a high-rise to block that light. It's also interesting that the same year that Wright built that, he built the Larkin Building in Buffalo, New York, which is an office building, but it had a communal workroom that was very similar in its sensibility and design, and that it had natural illumination and this great communal space. And that was torn down in 1950 to make way for a parking lot. So they did the right thing in Oak Park by not only preserving the architecture, but understanding the ideals and significance of the natural light.
Who let that happen? That's terrible. Our number is 800-486-8655 to your phone calls in a moment. I didn't know this, and maybe it's in the exhibit and I missed it. He had design, but it was never built, darn it. It's too bad it wasn't. A house for Marilyn Monroe?
I don't know about Marilyn Monroe. We have a design in this exhibition for Ayn Rand, an author who's very topical again, and it was never built. It's a very unusual design. It's similar to Falling Water, so it's a stunning composition, but she didn't know if she wanted to build it in Connecticut or Los Angeles. And for an architect who responds to the natural environment, this is sort of a big issue.
Falling Water. I got to say, that one just sort of takes my breath away. Have you been? I'd love to go there sometime. Have you been?
You know, I have not been, but it was important to us to not only have the drawings for this project, but to do something that could convey the experience. So we worked with the official photographer of Falling Water to create an 8-minute film loop that shows Falling Water through the four seasons with the sound. And he films not only the inside of the architecture and the outside, but the natural environment. So you get the whole experience of being there. And in the winter, when the waterfall is partially frozen, but it's still running, it's just the most stunning thing you've ever seen.
Oh, I'll bet it is. It's worth a trip. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Brady Roberts, chief curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum, is our guest. Daniel from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Fantastic show. Just a quick blurb before my statement is I have recently moved here with my partner about 4 years ago, and we met up with a friend that we used to know for many years that relocated here. And all we've been doing is, like, on birthdays and maybe a summer holiday, is trying to tour one of the Wright things, either in Illinois or here. And we started calling ourselves the Wright Three, which I do think is the kids' book.
Oh.
Just a little thing. But anyway, my question is, do you, with Frank's arrogance and kind of the scandalous life and just how he defied a lot of things, is that what actually made his career go through the 70 years? Which I understand his career was on and off, but is that kind of the drive?
Well, you know, he was a larger-than-life persona, and he felt that as an exceptional architect, the sort of social mores didn't apply to him, and he said as much. So, you know, he was a very theatrical figure. But I think that sort of got in the way of sort of his bigger visions of society in the United States. But people were responding to his brilliance as an architect. So he was receiving these commissions throughout his career. And there were, you know, fallow periods, but there were times in the United States where there wasn't much building going on. And if you look at the Depression, it's remarkable that he built Falling Water during the Depression, Jacob's House 1 in Madison, his first Usonian house, which is a very important sort of landmark for him, was built in 1936. S.C. Johnson corporate headquarters was built during the Depression. So he was remarkable, and people realized that, and they sought him out. I mean, he was out at Taliesin and in a rural part of the country, and people would find him and seek his commissions.
Thanks, Daniel. Tony in McGonigal, hi.
Good morning. This is going to be a challenge because for me, as a third-generation person interested in Mr. Wright's work, this is like a kid in a candy store kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the exhibit was marvelous. I was there on Thursday for Bruce Brooks Pfeiffer's lecture and so forth. Anyway, I did want to say, yes, he did design a home for Marilyn Monroe. It didn't get built, but he did design one.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was true.
Yeah. I grew up watching the Greek Orthodox Church being built.
Oh.
My father and my grandfather, as I mentioned, were I'm the third generation carpenter and home builder.
Mm.
And it was a fascinating project, and I do know the gentleman, John Ottenheimer, who is still alive, who actually built the building. But in any case, and I've worked on Wingspread, the restoration. I've worked out at Taliesin on furniture and so forth. But I just wanted to mention a few things for anyone who struggles a little bit with what Mr. Wright might be trying to say. My own personal opinion is that you need to be in the spaces. Drawings and photographs are great, but you really need to experience the buildings. The Seth Peet Cottage in Wisconsin Dells is one opportunity. And what I've learned is that when it was successful, eventually, if you're in the space for a period of time, the building, the architecture almost dissolves because he's really presenting nature to you. You're constantly in touch with the exterior, the light, the shadows, the changing colors, whatever it might be. And the building around you, almost it serves to present that to you, if I might say it that way.
Yeah, oh, I love that description. It is true. You don't know if you're inside or outside exactly.
Yeah, he did very consciously open these houses up to nature and blurred the line between where the architecture ends and nature begins. And again, that's something that he could do through technology, particularly the cantilever, which allowed him to open up whole walls to, especially the backyard, the garden. He would do that. And I should say that on our website, we do have a listing of Wright sites in the region.
Oh,
and, you know, they come in two flavors. There are the drive-bys where you can just go and look at the facade. But there are a number that are open to the public. So check out the website for those road trips that are right here in the state.
And the website is?
www.mam.org.
Okay. The other thing that you do a wonderful job of is inviting lecturers to come in and
yes.
do things with children. That's always a big part of the exhibit as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, we've got some great programs coming up. Starting tomorrow night, Mike Lillick is going to talk about the restoration of the Frank Lloyd Wright house on Burnham Street. And, you know, we have the only complete block of Frank Lloyd Wright houses here in Milwaukee. And Wright in Wisconsin, an organization, has one of these houses open to the public. And Mike's going to talk about the sort of heroic effort that went into the restoration of that house.
Wonderful.
But this is a beautiful example of his affordable small houses done in 1916. And this is a house that has about an 800-square-foot footprint, very small, but it feels very spacious. It's just a beautiful design. And then this Saturday, we're having a book salon addressing T.C. Boyle's book, The Women. So that should be terrific. That's at 10:30. On Saturday, and we do have a Family Sunday coming up March 6th, Family Sunday at the museum, and kids 12 and under are always free at the museum, but on March 6th, Family Sunday will revolve around the theme of architecture, so it should be a lot of fun.
Did you ever want to be an architect?
You know, I actually worked on restoration of a Wright house for two summers.
Did?
The first
I didn't know that.
Jacobs house in Madison, Wisconsin. I helped Jim Dennis, is an art historian who's my graduate advisor. He still lives there. He did the restoration from the foundation up. It's really a remarkable job that that he did. And I've always loved architecture. I'm an art historian who studied modern art and architecture, so I've always been fascinated by 20th century architecture, and Wright is certainly one of the key figures in the history of architecture from any period. Mm.
Let's go next to Ken in Bingham. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to thank you, I guess, for the exhibit. My wife and I gave each other a Milwaukee Art Museum membership for Valentine's Day. And
very nice.
Walked through your exhibit of Wright and the rest of the museum also, but we're just inspired by Wright's work and the beauty of, I think it's, the way I describe it, it's, you know, paintings are great and everything, but if you have a Wright house, you're living inside of a painting.
That's absolutely right. That's exactly what Herbert Jacobs said, who commissioned Wright to build that first Usonian house in Madison. He said it's like living in a picture, and it's true that Wright designed the space in a way that was sculptural and architectural and pictorial. And his houses don't need any other decoration. They are complete works of art.
Yeah. We have a few emails we haven't gotten to yet. Curtin Springbrook Brooke wanted to know about Lewis Mumford's influence on Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, I don't know that there's a direct influence on Wright's ideas of urban planning and urbanism from Lewis Mumford, and there are other kind of back to nature movements in the early 20th century, because basically there's a historic shift from the farm to the city with industrialization, and then there was a backlash to this, and Wright's visions can be seen as part of that kind of broader trend. But Broadacre City is a very specific set of ideas where Wright included every type of architecture that he designed, and it's all organic architecture. So all of these principles are manifest in Broadacre City, and that is distinct from anybody else's vision. But what the last caller said was really interesting to me, because he pointed out the most obvious thing about Wright's architecture, and that is the beauty. So, you know, when we're talking about these ideas that are important today and connecting with the landscape and local materials and efficiency and so forth, the amazing thing is that he could do all of this, and he was constantly original and constantly designing beautiful architecture year after year, decade after decade, through his entire career.
Yeah, it's something. Thanks, Ken. Steve in Madison, hi.
Hi. My dad grew up in Richland Center in the 1920s. He was a little kid. Huh. And I was always fascinated with Frank Lloyd Wright. And I'd ask my dad, why didn't Richland Center ever... All he ever left Richland Center was a warehouse. And my dad told me that Frank Lloyd Wright virtually got run out of town because he owed everybody money. He just didn't pay any bills, and they just didn't like him. And the convention center, what I'm saying is the convention center in Madison, the Monona Terrace, beautiful, beautiful. But the biggest hang-up about the convention center ever being built was it wasn't because it was a financing or whatever. It was because of his moral values. And I wonder how much didn't get built because there was opposition to his... Mm. Well, his ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was really a big issue for him locally, as you suggest, more so than other places. So when, he ran off with the wife of a client from Chicago and then settled in Spring Green, and the locals knew that, and they didn't condone that sort of behavior. And then Wright was aware that that people had that view. So he called a press conference and he explained to people that he appreciated these social values and mores, but they didn't apply to him because he was a brilliant architect. So this was true of bills too, that those were really for ordinary people, and he was someone extraordinary. So that's, you know, that's how he viewed himself, and that's how he behaved. And he did pay a price for that, particularly locally, but it did not stop people nationally, regionally, and nationally from commissioning him, because he was, you know, certainly the greatest architect in America in the 20th century.
And then she winds up dying in that fire with her two children.
It's terrible. And their servant went crazy. And Frank Lloyd Wright was in Chicago meeting clients. I think he was working on the Midway Gardens project. And this servant went crazy and killed people, killed Mama Borthwick, and burned the house. So, you know, it's just absolutely devastating for Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah, I imagine. All right, nuts and bolts here. It is on now, and it runs through?
May 15th.
At the Milwaukee Art Museum. And it must have been such a pleasure for you to put this all together, wasn't it?
It was extraordinary working with Bruce Brooks Pfeiffer, the director of the Frank Lloyd Wright Archives. As I mentioned, they have 22,000 drawings by Frank Lloyd Wright. It's headquartered at Taliesin West in Scottsdale, so we would meet out there and talk about these ideas and look at Wright's drawings and talk about his projects. And it was really magical to be involved with this project.
Mm, I would imagine. Well, it's wonderful, as all the exhibits are. It's my favorite place in town. I've always said that. But
thank
you walk
you
in
much.
That place, and you don't even need to see an exhibit. You just... look.
It's an extraordinary thing. It's interesting that on this 100th anniversary of Taliesin, it's also the 10th anniversary of our Calatrava building. And when Calatrava was commissioned to build the Milwaukee Art Museum, he traveled around and looked at Wright's architecture. And when you see the S.C. Johnson building, that cathedral-like quality that it has, and you look at how the Calatrava building connects with Lake Michigan, it's a really Wright-inspired project.
Thank you so much for being with us. Brady Roberts, Chief Curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We've had a death in our family. My mother-in-law died, so I will not be here tomorrow. I'll be going north to wish her a fond farewell. She was quite a woman. So we'll have great shows repeated tomorrow. Thanks for listening.